بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Answering the doubts and questions and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah who is Ar-Rahman. Allah who is Al-Mannan.
La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum and welcome to yet another edition from series of Q&A in Islamic Beliefs from IRIB English Radio. In these series of shows, we are trying to ask and answer some doubts and misconceptions which is usually being asked by different questioners and theological and Islamic issues. So for this series of shows, we have been inviting scholars and researchers from Qom Seminary Schools. Like always, we have Sheikh Murtada Karimi in the studio with us, and we shall start our questions with him. But before starting the discussion, I'd like to welcome Sheikh and say salam to Sheikh Murtada.
Wa alaikum salam, and thank you for having me.
Thanks for accepting the invitation, Sheikh. Dear brothers and sisters, the question of the day actually is the continuation of our previous show, which was concerning the harms and the bad effects of porn industry on the mind and, let's say, psyche and the soul of a person. Actually, it was covered from an Islamic perspective in our previous session, and it was actually answered and explained in depth that what Islam says with regard to watching pornography, watching porn videos, or let's say porn pictures. Now we want to look into the harms of this unfortunate and harms and bad effects of this this phenomena on the soul of the human being, on the mind of a person, and the bad effects that it might have to the brain of a person. So it can be a sort of scientific discussion here, as we are done with the Islamic perspective on this issue. We said that it is haram totally, so we are not allowed to watch or see and look at any of those scenes or pictures or videos. Now we want to see what are the probable harms and bad effects of this phenomena on the soul of a human being. Sheikhana, this was the question that we received it, and now we are waiting for your enlightenment on the issue.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As you rightly mentioned, we said that Islam is against producing pornography and watching that. But when it comes to today's science, it's not the matter of religion anymore. Almost, we can say that all the scholars agree that pornography is against the health of one's psyche and brain. So we know that pornography is not showing only a sexual relation. It is presenting a culture for the people. It is presenting a sexual example for the people.
Yeah.
And that is why it is harmful. The point is that, let me refer to some of these harms. First of all, we know that at least in many cases, women are humiliated in this unfortunate industry.
Mm-hmm.
So woman is only a means for satiating the lust of the men, at least in most of the cases. So the honor of women is absolutely disrespected in pornography. Besides that, we know that in pornography, some fantasies are created for the men. I mean, they think, watching the videos, men may come to this conclusion that the way that they have sexual desires they have sexual relations with their wives is far away from the one that they are watching in these videos. Because as I mentioned, these videos, they make some fantasies for the men. Now, it's been mentioned by the scientists that the men who get used to watching videos, in a short term, or at least in long term, they will get somehow, let's put it this way, disappointed with their own wives. They do not feel, I mean, their sexual desires are not going to be satiated anymore in their intimate relation with their wives. Or it doesn't make any difference even for women who watch such videos. After some time, they feel that they are not sexually satiated by their husbands. Mm-hmm. What is the reason? The reason is that they have watched many videos, and those videos, as I mentioned, they are showing some fantasies, and now these people wait for the same in their real life. They do not achieve it, and they get disappointed, and statistics have showed that the number of divorce, which is the result of watching pornography, is, I mean, for the men and women who get used to watching pornography, the possibility of getting divorced is more compared to the people who are away from that. And one of the main reasons is the fact that, as I mentioned, the after getting used to watching porn videos, they somehow, their expectations from their mate increase. They wait for the same fantasies that they see in the porn movies.
Very true.
And that is why their sexual desires are not satiated. They get disappointed, and it would lead to divorce. So mm-hmm. it's been scientifically proved that, according to the statistics, at least the possibility of getting divorced for people who are away from watching porn videos is much less than the people who get used to that.
Sheikhana, can we liken the harms of this phenomenon to the harms that actually Islam can be seen in the harms of the music? Like, by music, I mean the ghina music, which is technically called in Islamic terminology as ghina. You see, the ghina music actually brings the human being into fantasy, actually, and makes him distant from the reality, and does not let him to live in whatever he has to be, or he must to be, or she must to be. So the same thing actually can be applied to these sexual sins that brings to the human being and makes him distant and away from what the reality is. And when he faces the reality, for example, his halal partner, he finds that he cannot be the same that he the same as what he has been, what he has seen already. So I think the hurma, or the unlawfulness of it, comes from this source. Can it be looked as this as well?
Yeah, this is interesting, and let me confirm what you mentioned by referring to a research done by some of the Western scholars. I think they were from Cambridge University. They have come to this conclusion that the brain of those people who get used to watching videos, porn videos, is somehow like the people who are addicted to drinking alcohol or consuming drugs.
Very true.
So this is very interesting. I mean, as you rightly mentioned, we may compare it to listening to music, which make people away from reality. And alcohol and drug, they also do the same. I mean, making people away from reality, living in fantasies. Now, according to this research by some of the scholars from Cambridge University, watching porn videos has the same effect. I mean, the brain of these people is exactly like the brain of alcoholic people or the one who are addicted to consuming drugs. And we know that Islam is the religion of reality. And not only Islam, I mean every human being needs to live a real life and not to live in fantasies. It's been also proved that watching porn videos, it increases the secretion of special hormones in a person's body.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't make any difference if you're a woman and or if you are a man. It is proved in science that hormone secretion, I mean some hormone secretion will be increased after and during watching porn videos. And it leads to the brain to become somehow tired and a kind of fatigue for the brain, and it in a long term it will affect a person's memory and concentration. Again, I repeat, I'm not talking about, I mean, Islamic researchers. These are done by, I mean, Western scholars or Eastern scholars, irrespective of their religion.
Very true.
They have come to this conclusion that watching the porn videos will, I mean, will lead to some hormones secretion, and the secretion of these hormones will come to one's losing his memories and concentration, at least in the long term.
Very true.
The other problem is for the kids. Nowadays, unfortunately, we know that many teenagers, they are also getting used to watching porn videos because of the fact that there is no control over watching the videos by the parents or by the website and so on and so forth. Scholars believe that especially for teenagers and kids below 14 years of age, it's absolutely harmful to their brain, and it will bring about great changes in their behavior. Imagine, mm-hmm. I mean, a child who doesn't know anything about the sexual relations between the people, including his or her parents, suddenly he sees all these, explicit scenes in such movies. It would drastically change their mindset, even in their relation. The relation between themselves and their parents.
True.
And especially for the kids, for the teenagers, in the long term, it will lead to a very negative consequence. And it's been mentioned that it's very likely for these kids to, get mature much earlier than the normal age, and then begin because they are not able to get married, to begin masturbation. And again, we have studies which tell us that about the harms of masturbation, especially when it comes to teenagers and kids. So all in all, we can conclude that watching pornography is harmful to the families,
and also the side effects that it brings actually about, as you said, actually it make some youngsters to move towards masturbation, which also from the other on the other hand is harmful to the health of the person, and also actually it brings a sort of internal conflict in the mind and
exactly.
in the brain of the person, and makes it unfortunately in a mess. Even the side effects of it is not that good. When regardless of what actually you said, that it humiliates a human being in general first,
mm-hmm.
the man or the woman who are involved in such
That's
actions.
True.
And then, on the other hand, the kids and youngsters who are afflicted, who are affected by the side effects of it.
So at the end of the day, I believe that the foundation of family is threatened by pornography.
Very true.
Whether it is the relation between wife and husband or the relation between the children and their parents.
Very beautiful.
It would be highly threatened by this unfortunate industry.
From any aspect, if we look at this, when we see the philosophy behind what Islam says, it is haram or it is not allowed to be watched or to be seen and to be looked at, actually shows itself here in the outcome of it. If so, as we said, as it was said in the show, porn industry actually affects different fundamentals, different foundations, the foundation of family, the foundation of the family, the relationship between actually the mental damage that it brings to the youngsters, and also the humiliation that it brings to humanity and humans in general. These are among the bad effects of it, which shows explicitly why Islam says and declares something as haram and forbidden to be touched and to be approached. So may Allah. So let's thank Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for our ni'mah, the blessing of the religion of Islam, for bestowing us that beautiful religion that brings these blessings to us, that to gives us this philosophy, this beautiful philosophy that we need to ponder to see what are behind the layers of this philosophy that is actually worthy of pondering on. Many thanks, dear Sheikh, for your explanations, and your respect and listeners for your staying tuned and listening to Q&A in Islamic Beliefs from IRB English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum.
Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. لعلي وحسين وحسن.
Communicate.
Israel has been boasting that its rollout of the COVID-19 vaccine has been the most successful in the world, and that it's inoculated a higher percentage of its population than anyone else. What Israel has not been telling you is that they're only counting their Jewish population. The Palestinians living under Israeli occupation have been purposely excluded from receiving the vaccine. Today we look at the truth behind Israel's claim and their medical apartheid towards the Palestinian people. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. Right now, countries all across the world are buying up stocks of the COVID-19 vaccine in order to inoculate their populations after a year of lockdowns and restrictions. There are several vaccines being developed, like the Sputnik vaccine, a collaboration under Russia, or the Pfizer vaccine, which is the one that Israel has been buying up. Israel made a deal for an undisclosed amount with Pfizer, which would also provide the pharmaceutical giant with data and health information about its population. Israel began rolling out the vaccine in December 2020, which requires that each person take 2 shots 3 weeks apart. Israel, of course, never misses a chance to show off, and Netanyahu has been proudly boasting about how fast he was able to secure so many doses of the vaccine and administer them to his population. And the media has also been singing Israel's praises, citing it as an example of efficiency. The New York Times writing that Israel has become a world leader in vaccinating against COVID-19. And it's true. If you look at the figures, Israel has a higher rate of inoculation than anyone else. The problem is, those numbers are lying. Those numbers do not include the 5 million Palestinians living under Israel's illegal occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. The Guardian first reported on January 3rd, 2021, how Israel transports batches of the Pfizer vaccine deep into the West Bank, but they are only distributed to Jewish settlers and not the roughly 2.7 million Palestinians living around them, who may have to wait for weeks or months. According to the BBC, Palestinians living in East Jerusalem, which is also under illegal occupation, are entitled to be vaccinated as they're considered residents. However, Palestinians living in the West Bank or in Gaza, being illegally occupied by Israel, are not. The only people in those areas that are entitled to be vaccinated are the Zionist settlers who are living there illegally. Israel's military occupation, its Zionist settlements, these are all illegal under international law. There are numerous UN Security Council resolutions clearly, unequivocally stating that Israel must leave and that these settlements are illegal under international law. Matthias Kennis, a medic from Doctors Without Borders who works in the West Bank, also wrote in late February how he was shocked by Israel's cruelty, saying, quote, "You are over 60 times more likely to have a vaccination in Israel than in Palestine. Kenneth goes on to say that a few kilometers away in Israel, all the vulnerable groups have been vaccinated, and they are planning to move on to vaccinating healthy adults and youths who are less vulnerable, especially to severe complications. Here in the West Bank, there are around 10,000 doses, which is enough for 5,000 people to be vaccinated. In the hospital where I work, staff have been offered the vaccine, but the available doses do not come close to covering the healthcare workers, let alone the elderly and people with medical conditions that make them susceptible to dying of COVID-19. The United States Senator and former presidential candidate Bernie Sanders wrote a joint letter with other senators urging Secretary of State Blinken to pressure Israel to vaccinate Palestinians. In the letter, it states that, quote, while the Oslo Accords give the Palestinian Authority considerable responsibility for the health care of Palestinians, the Accords do not supersede Israel's responsibilities under the Fourth Geneva Convention. And this is absolutely correct. Because you see, this is what the Israelis are trying to argue. They're claiming that they have no legal obligation to vaccinate Palestinians, despite the fact that they're illegally occupying Palestinians. The Israelis claim that under the Oslo Accords of 1995, if you look at Annex 3, Article 17, it says, quote, powers and responsibilities in the sphere of health in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip will be transferred to the Palestinian side, including the health insurance system. However, under Article 56 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, it says that, quote, the occupying power, which is Israel in this case, has the duty of ensuring and maintaining, with the cooperation of national and local authorities, the medical and hospital establishments and services, public health and hygiene in the occupied territory, with particular reference to the adoption and application of the prophylactic and preventative measures necessary to combat the spread of contagious diseases and epidemics. It's important to note, however, that the Oslo Accords, they were a bilateral agreement between the Israelis and Palestinians. The Geneva Convention is much larger than that, much older than that. It's a pillar of international law. So it's completely irrational and unreasonable to argue that the Oslo Accords somehow cancel out or supersede the Geneva Convention, which Israel and Palestine are both a party to. Also, even if you want to take the Israelis' argument at face value, how can you expect the Palestinians to be in charge of their own health affairs when Israel is occupying them? How are Palestinians expected to run an efficient healthcare system and build public health infrastructure when they are told what they can and can't import, when they are told when and where they can go, when they don't even have a state, when they are living under a brutal Zionist occupation that denies them their basic human rights? And if the occupation wasn't bad enough, every single time Israel viciously bombs Gaza, it purposely targets civilian and public health infrastructure. And while Mr. Erdan, who is Israel's ambassador to the United Nations, claims on Twitter that the Palestinian Authority is responsible for its own health affairs and that Israel will facilitate their purchase of the Sputnik vaccine from Russia, well, hold on a second. Why would Israel need to facilitate Palestinians' purchase of a vaccine if Palestinians are responsible for their own health affairs? There's a bit of a contradiction there, don't you think? And of course, even that turned out to be a lie. When Gaza tried to import vaccines from Russia, Israel blocked it. A shipment of a mere 1,000 doses, which is barely enough for 500 people, was still blocked by Israel. This is so emblematic of their wicked treatment towards Palestinians. According to Al Jazeera, Israeli lawmakers were even debating whether to let in vaccines out of fear that they would go to Hamas leadership. Well, here's a solution. Why not just give all Palestinian civilians vaccines? Then you won't have to worry about that, right? So Israel even waited 3 months. Since December, they waited 3 months before giving vaccines to the 100,000 plus Palestinians that it uses as cheap labor who cross over into Israel every day. Here's a PR photo that they put out in some depraved attempt to make themselves look like humanitarian occupiers and whitewash their occupation. I mean, it's so dehumanizing. Israel still has millions of vaccines, while millions of Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza have none. And like with all criticisms of Zionism, Israel grew furious when people began calling out its racist medical apartheid towards Palestinians. The Guardian was accused of lying and asked to apologize over its articles. Even Michael Che, who joked on Saturday Night Live about Israel only vaccinating its Jewish population, was accused of racism. Netanyahu, along with Danny Dunan and several other Israeli officials, quickly rushed to accuse him of anti-Semitism. So while the Israelis have been able to enjoy an easing of lockdown restrictions and a drop in infections of COVID-19, just earlier this month, on March 11, Palestinians saw their worst day yet with a record 27 fatalities and 2,300 registered cases in a single day. And while Palestinians have been able to acquire some 2,000 doses from Israel, 10,000 doses of the Sputnik vaccine from Russia, and another 60,000 doses delivered by the United Nations through its COVAX program, this is nowhere near enough to inoculate a population of 5 million. Even since last year in May 2020, the United Nations asked Israel to have mercy on the hundreds of Palestinian children that it keeps in its jails and to release them for fear that they might catch COVID or spark an outbreak. Israel ignored this request and is still illegally detaining Palestinian children, just as we saw a few days ago in Hebron, continuing to brutalize them and doesn't even care to release them or inoculate them, putting their health at further risk. And in December of 2020, initially, Israel's public security minister, Amir Ohana, refused to allow Palestinian prisoners to be vaccinated in Israeli jails, and only for prison staff to be vaccinated. He even defied the orders of the health minister. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Is Asa Winstanley, investigative journalist and podcaster for Electronic Intifada. He writes extensively about Palestine. He's lived in Palestine. Thanks so much for taking the time, Asa. It's good to have you on.
Great to be with you, Richard. I've been a fan of your show, and you're doing really great work, so it's brilliant to be on.
Thank you. I appreciate it. So, Asa, I want to start out with the medical apartheid that's happening in occupied Palestine. You know, the Israelis are refusing to vaccinate Palestinians. What did you think of this idea that Israel wants to send vaccines to countries that will move their embassy to Jerusalem?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, Israel uses all tools that it can in the world, you know, to try and put pressure on countries to favor its international goals, you know. I mean, it uses all kinds of nefarious methods, so it's not completely surprising, but you're right. I mean, it's a typically despicable thing for them to do. And, you know, the thing that struck me as well was they started this program for vaccines for foreign diplomats living in Tel Aviv mostly, although, of course, the Americans have moved to Jerusalem now. And they're going to be vaccinating them, you know. But still, there's millions of Palestinians living in territories controlled by Israel that have not been vaccinated and have no entitlement to vaccines under Israeli apartheid.
So, I mean, how is the situation looking now? Because, you know, Israel says, oh, we're number one in vaccinations, but they're not counting the Palestinians that they're occupying. And now in March, Israel says they'll start vaccinating some of the Palestinian workers that cross over. So, I mean, is that it? Is that as far as it goes?
Under Israel's apartheid system, only the Jews, only the Israeli Jews have an entitlement to all sorts of different privileges, you know, and this is Israel's apartheid system. 6 million Palestinians living in the West Bank and Gaza Strip have no basic human or political rights under Israel's apartheid system. This is why it's called apartheid system, which, you know, there's literally different legal system for them. So this extends to the entitlement to vaccines as well. And it's only after Israel's come under massive amount of pressure and international criticism that they've even begun offering even a small token amount of Palestinians, the Palestinians who work in Israeli settlements, work in what's called Israel proper, beyond the green line, supposed, offering a limited amount of them some vaccines. And it's only, you know, because of this the description of it as vaccine apartheid, it's become a very sensitive issue for them. So they've offered these few vaccines, and now they're saying, well, it's not apartheid because, you know, we're offering some Palestinians the vaccine.
So, I mean, all these Israeli officials now, they're responding to this criticism by saying that it's anti-Semitic. And, you know, they even got mad at this SNL joke. I mean, what is that? Isn't that obscene how they're calling out anyone who exposes their refusal to abide by the Fourth Geneva Convention as anti-Semitic?
Yeah, I mean, this is the tactic. this is Israel's tactic, isn't it? It's always Israel's tactic is to distract from its crimes by accusing its critics of having some sort of ulterior motive, you know. And the Saturday Night Live incident was a good example of that. You know, there was this comedian Michael Che, I think you say his name, who made this joke of that Israel is reporting that they vaccinated half of their population, and I'm going to guess that it's the Jewish half. Well, it was a joke. It was quite a funny joke, but it was basically true, you know, because Israel was offering only, as I said, like the Jewish half of the population was really the only people who were offered the vaccine. And what illustrates that more than ever is the fact that Israeli settlers in the West Bank, even, which even under international law, which, you know, the US and everyone, Britain claims to abide by but doesn't, even under that law, those settlements in the West Bank are illegal under international law. Well, only Jews can live in them. And Israeli Jewish citizens living in those settlements, illegal settlements, were given and had right to the vaccine, but the Palestinians living in nearby communities were not, you know. So that's just a perfect example of it. And yeah, Israel's strategy is always to accuse its critics of anti-Semitism, and starting with the Palestinians.
So, I mean, Israel, they're saying that the Oslo Accords relieve them of their obligation to abide by the Fourth Geneva Convention. Do you think it's true that a bilateral agreement can just cancel out a superseding international law, which is universal, essentially?
No, of course not. I mean, even the Oslo Accords themselves, which, you know, in my view, are illegitimate anyway, but even the Oslo Accords themselves state that Israel has an obligation to provide the Palestinian Authority with support during pandemics, you know. So it doesn't relieve Israel of its obligations under international law to provide basic services. Of course, in reality, the whole goal of the Oslo Accords was to essentially subcontract out Israeli occupation to, you know, an indigenous agent, essentially. You know, like all settler colonial powers, like all instances of imperialism, Israel relies on, tries to, and in certain circumstances has been, you know, has had some measures of success to recruit native agents for its power, you know, like the British, when they occupied India, would set different religious communities against each other in order to kind of to divide and rule and to increase their power. So the Israelis know that the Palestinian Authority can keep knows its population better than they could possibly, and it's kind of a mask for them. It's kind of, it's a way for them to kind of launder their image and you know, get away from fulfilling its obligations under international law.
Yeah, and now some Arab countries as well. And, you know, I'm a bit curious because I know it's a rhetorical question, I think, but, you know, the ICC is probing Israel for war crimes, and now we have Israel violating the Geneva Convention yet again. Do you think that there are going to be any actual consequences for what Israel is doing to the Palestinians in regards to depriving them of vaccines? I know that's kind of a rhetorical question. I don't think anyone is going to actually do anything to them, but what do you think the long-term effects of this will be?
The ICC investigation is an interesting one because it's true, you know, that it's been very slow in happening. The chief prosecutor of the ICC has announced this, and she's on her way out. To clarify, she hasn't been sacked, but she's stepping down from her role, and just before she stepped down, I can't remember if it was just before or just after, but round about the same time she stepped down, she's finally, after years of talking about it and kind of prevaricating, said, okay, we are going to launch an investigation into Israeli war crimes in the Gaza Strip and West Bank. Now, it's interesting because I think the ICC... if you look at the record of the ICC, I'm not an expert on it, but I think we all know and we can all see that almost only the only people that the ICC has prosecuted so far are political leaders who are black Africans, essentially, who are accused of war crimes. And the war crimes of the West and of Israel have not been touched by it. So I think, as an international body, these international bodies like the UN and the International Criminal Court and the World Court as well before it, as ostensibly international bodies, I think they do come under pressure to an extent from people in, you know, what used to be called the Third World, the Global South, and political leaders there who are starting to notice, hang on, you're only prosecuting black Africans. What's going on here? You know, what about Britain's crimes in Iraq? What about the US crimes in Afghanistan? You know, what about European colonial crimes? You know, if we're going back in time, you know, all over the world. And in a way, in some ways, Israel is the last outpost of European colonialism that is still ongoing as a active settler colonial project. You know, the French were driven out of Algeria by an anti-colonial rebellion. You know, if you go back further, Haiti was the first state in the world to abolish slavery when the former enslaved Africans liberated themselves from the brutality of French slavery, and then they fought off, you know, they fought off three colonial powers: the British, the Spanish, and the French, and to become free. So, like, Israel is a settler colonial project which is still ongoing in this way, which was launched by a Western European power under the auspices of the British Empire. So I suppose in a way the ICC agreeing to prosecute that, it could be the start of something, which is why it has been viewed as dangerous by the British government and the US government, with the US government even sanctioning the chief prosecutor of the ICC, you know, at Israel's behest, at Israel's request. And that was done under the Trump administration. The same sanctions are under place, you know, even though Biden's the great white hope. Yeah, they're still in place. So these vindictive Trump sanctions are still being enforced by the Biden administration. So it depends. Let's see what happens. There are some very good Palestinian lawyers who have been working for many years now to try and use these institutions to get what they're ostensibly designed to do, right? Which is achieve justice for people who have been subjected to these crimes.
I want to remind you very briefly of Israel's recent history and how it treats healthcare workers, doctors, and what it does to Palestinian health infrastructure, right? Do you remember during 2009, during Operation Castlet, Israel purposely deprived Palestinians of food, of medical supplies, of essential care, and deliberately blocked and otherwise impeded emergency relief and humanitarian assistance, and purposely targeted vehicles that were carrying humanitarian relief, and violated international law. In 2014, during Israel's ground invasion of Gaza, Israel killed over 2,200 Palestinians. 65% of them were civilians. The UN found that, quote, 17 hospitals, 56 primary healthcare facilities, and 45 ambulances were damaged or destroyed. The total cost to Gaza's healthcare system, $50 million. 16 healthcare workers were killed, and 83, most of them ambulance drivers and volunteers, were injured. Then also in 2018-2019, during the Right to Return marches, Israel purposely shot at and targeted unarmed Palestinians, wounding thousands of them and killing over 180. Among them, medical staff. A report by the United Nations found that Israeli snipers intentionally shot healthcare workers, despite seeing that they were clearly marked as such. One of those healthcare workers was 20-year-old Ruzan al-Najjar, who worked tirelessly as a medic to help the injured and tend to the wounded. Her death caused widespread outrage, and the Israeli occupation forces even tried to smear her after one of their own snipers deliberately killed her. Gaza itself, which has been devastated by Israel's ruthless bombings over and over, has been under siege from Israel and Egypt since 2007, with only limited humanitarian supplies being allowed through. Even construction materials are not permitted. Israel literally picks and chooses what Palestinians in Gaza can bring into their own country. A UN report from 2009 states that the Israeli blockade is one of the main reasons there is not enough medical equipment or medical supplies available. All this to say that Israel is no problem killing medical workers and medics and doctors and destroying medical and public health infrastructure belonging to Palestinians. So of course, when it suits Israel, Israel claims that Palestinians are autonomous and that they can deal with their own health issues. And yet when something doesn't suit them, like the International Criminal Court saying it will investigate them for war crimes, then all of a sudden, Israel claims that this is not possible, that Palestine is not a real state, and the ICC can't expand jurisdiction there. Sheer hypocrisy. This is what occupation looks like. This is Israel's true face. Not the one that they sell you in the mainstream media about how Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. That's a fairy tale slogan. Israel is not a democracy. Israel is a racist, colonialist, settler project that was created by the United Kingdom. Israel treats Palestinians like they are less than human. Israel, since its foundation, has been ethnically cleansing the Palestinian people, bulldozing their homes, turning them into refugees, killing them in cold blood. Israel is one of the biggest human rights violators on the face of this planet. It has no respect for the Geneva Convention, nor for international law. Israel has purposely targeted public health infrastructure, purposely targeted medical workers, purposely targeted nurses, doctors, and paramedics, and this is documented by virtually every single news outlet and human rights organization that exists. So it's absolutely no surprise that an apartheid, genocidal regime like that would now deprive Palestinians of a vaccine even during a global pandemic on their own land and then try to whitewash its racist apartheid crimes and boast about how successful it is. This is just another chapter in Israel's long and brutal oppression of the Palestinian people, its cruel and inhumane treatment of them during war and during occupation. This depraved, wicked treatment of Palestinians will go down in history as one of the worst crimes against humanity. And people will scratch their heads. How the entire world, including many Arab nations, stood by watching and did nothing. It's an absolute disgrace, and anyone with a conscience can see that. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Gifted and Safi, Ramadan Mubarak, Holy Records.
Ramadan Mubarak, لكل مسلم, شهر لذيذ فيها, ينزل القرآن. Happy Ramadan to all Muslims, all the Quran descends in this holy month.
Insights into the Holy Quran. A special program for the holy month of Ramadan.
Welcome you, O holy man of blessings. Oh, yeah. You are seek nearness to my creator. For you, my soul and heart has been purified.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. This is a special program for the holy month of Ramadan. In today's program, Hujjatul Islam Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi explains some verses related to this blessed month. Please stay with us.
O month of mercy, you bring so much good. We pray that it never ends, but we know you gotta go as the seasons come and go, 'cause your time is set by Allah. Oh Ramadan, oh Ramadan, you're the month of the noble Quran.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين. ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarisi with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. We're going to be with you in this holy month of Ramadan, talking about the different verses of the Holy Quran regarding the benefits of fasting, the most important of them, piety or taqwa. We'll be with you again after you have listened to some verses of the Holy Quran regarding fasting.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu kutiba alaykumus siyamu kama kutiba alalladhina min qablikum la'allakum tattaqun.
O you who have believed, decreed upon you is fasting as it was decreed upon those before you, that you may become righteous.
As we mentioned earlier, we have some traditions interpreting the word patience in this verse, وَاسْتَعِينُوا بِالصَّبْرِ وَالصَّلَاةِ, as fasting. Patience means sabr and is actually the very first element of spiritual journey to God. And then we found out there must be a kind of relation between the revelations that occurred during the fasting time, or in our religion during the month of Ramadan, and the spiritual aspects of fasting, or maybe other benefits. Shortly, thus, we mentioned the physical healing and also the social healing of fasting as two important factors, but we believe that the most important and the main benefit of religious fasting is its spiritual healing. The Holy Quran in this regard, in chapter Baqarah, says, يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا كُتِبَ عَلَيْكُمُ الصِّيَامُ كَمَا كُتِبَ عَلَى الَّذِينَ مِنْ قَبْلِكُمْ لَعَلَّكُمْ تَتَّقُونَ. O you who believe, fasting is prescribed to you as it was prescribed to those before you, that you may gain self-restraint. In this part, we have to gain another look at fasting. Fasting is not only prevention from eating and drinking, it is prevention from certain things, most of which are not only normally permissible, but also even quite essential in our lives. By fasting, we avoid food and drink, which are the main nutritional sources of our body, and this challenge against permissible and normally useful inputs is somehow to give us the strength to avoid taking things that are harmful, including toxins for our body. Not just for our body. The point is, we have to try to avoid the toxins for our soul as well. In other words, we have to look, are we able to fast against halal food and soft drink over a month? Should I not be able by far to fast against intoxicants and haram foods over a year? And this is in spite of the fact that the first are my essential needs and the latter are not. A religious fasting is not just a physical diet program. When we fast from food, we are expected to also fast from all harmful and forbidden actions and intentions.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
شهر رمضان الذي أنزل فيه القرآن هدى للناس وبينات من الهدى والفرقان فمن شهد منكم الشهر فليصم ومن كان مريضا أو على سفر فعدة من أيام أخر يريد الله بكم اليسر ولا يريد بكم العسر ولتكملوا العدة ولتكبروا الله وَلِتُكَبِّرُوا اللَّهَ عَلَى مَا هَدَاكُمْ وَلَعَلَّكُمْ تَشْكُرُونَ.
The month of Ramadan is that in which was revealed the Quran, a guidance for the people and clear proofs of guidance and criterion. So whoever cites the new moon of the month, let him fast it. And whoever is ill or on a journey, then an equal number of other days. Allah intends for you ease and does not intend for you hardship, and wants for you to complete the period and to glorify Allah for that to which He has guided you, and perhaps you will be grateful.
Just as fasting in its physical aspect had this detoxification benefit, it is also having a process of spiritual detoxification as well. Fasting, if made with the intention of closeness to God, can ascend someone from the kingdom of animals to the realm of the angels. Some friend of mine had this sentence, and it is really beautiful. He said that by fasting, you close your physical mouth to open your spiritual mouth. You fast your body, and you let your spirit feast, but mysteriously. When you fast, you empty your stomach from bread to fill it up with unique, glorious pearls that are not visible. Moreover, fasting can be counted as the heart of servitude. Servitude means ubudiyya, and ubudiyya is made by supplication most of the time. In ubudiyya, you have to turn your heart to the God Almighty, and you have to detach yourself from all other than Him. Fasting is prevention. Prevention means separation and detachment. And detachment is the heart and reality of servitude to God. By detachment, you mean I have no one else to turn to. And the results are visible. When you are ordered by this Almighty Allah to do something, and something is made compulsory, you don't bring up questions, asking Him what the benefits are for me to do so. If He is your Lord, if He is the absolute cause, if He is your Creator, you do not have the right to ask such questions. And this is the heart of servitude and ubudiyya. And fasting, by prevention and separation, is detachment, and this is the heart and reality of servitude. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to us. If you have any question or comment, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at farstoday.com. May Allah accept your deeds in this holy month of Ramadan, and please include all Muslims in your prayers. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Forgive us and guide us to paradise. Ramadan is here. Allah's mercy is near. Time to give, time to share, time to show we care. 'Cause Ramadan is here.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Proper Nutrition with Brother Sayyid Vahid Alavi in the program The Month of Allah.
Assalamu alaikum, everyone, and welcome back to The Month of Allah.
in the last program, we talked about the different aspects of how to eat, and I will continue with the same question and try to answer the question. We reached number three. The sentence of Bismillah should be said before eating the food, and that is to give thanks. Why do we do that? We say thanks to Allah for all the benefits that Allah has given us, and we start every act and deed with the name of Allah. Imam Ali alayhi salam says, if someone starts his eating with the name of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, I would guarantee that person that he would not be inflicted with any suffering or disease or pain or distress from that food. Bismillah contains the word of Allah. You have the word of Allah in the sentence of Bismillah. And Allah, when you read and study the Quran and the Ahadith, you see that the different names of Allah have different traits or attributes of Allah. They're referring to a certain trait or attribute of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But the name of Allah in itself is a comprehensive name. It contains all the different traits and attributes within it in the name of Allah. Number four, halal livelihood. Now, Islam emphasizes a lot on this aspect, that where from have you taken or gotten your livelihood? Because it does not matter if your livelihood is haram and you spend with that haram money on halal food, that the bad aspects of that food or that money that you have brought in your house will affect your behavior and your moral traits and so on and so forth. Therefore, a lot of emphasis has been placed on halal livelihood. Occasionally, we see some people who have difficulties taking any job. They want a job who would fit their personal status in the society, or they say that maybe this certain job is not fit for someone like me, or I don't want to do any job that has to do with my hands or trade and so on and so forth. How do we deal with it? It seems like someone came to Imam Sadiq alayhi salam and he said, I am in a huge need, but I do not like to work with my hands or do any trade. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam responds and says, work although it is a burden for you, so that you do not become in need of others. We will continue with the same question of how to eat in the coming programs, inshallah ta'ala. Till next time, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon all of you. Ramadan Kareem.
صفاته نبع الهدى نلقى الجنان بحبه لن تستقيم حياتنا إلا به هو القرآن والفرقان إليه تنصت الأكوان وفيه تعطر الآذان
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Shadow World, directed by Johan Grimman-Prez.